subsidized daycare, and they sign in with an electronic fingerprint.
You have to scan your finger, and everybody just, oh, yeah, I bet she's on welfare, and she gets food stamps, you know, just singling people out.
Mississippi's controversial experiment to reduce welfare fraud. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Hostess Brands and its second largest union have agreed to a day of mediation to see if they can end a baker's strike and prevent the company from shutting down. The parties meet today with a bankruptcy judge. The judge announced on Monday he wasn't ready to approve a liquidation. NPR's Lisa Chang reports.
The Twinkie maker says it's going to take this opportunity to try to save the company and 18,000 jobs, but
whether that opportunity can actually lead to something is anyone's guess.
Lance Inyon is a company spokesman. What isn't a mystery, he says, is how expensive this delay will be for Hostess. It costs $1 million a day just to fund payroll. So if the mediation fails, Hostess expects to go right back to court on Wednesday and ask for the liquidation to begin. The ailing business has filed for bankruptcy twice and has been trying to sell itself off. But it says potential buyers weren't biting because the union contracts, especially the pension benefits, were just too costly.
There's no one that's going to come in and purchase the company on exactly the same terms that was leading to the company's liquidation.
And that's why labor experts say if a new buyer swoops in, it may not be the white knight workers are hoping for. Calls to the Baker's Union were not returned. Hostess says no one has offered to buy the company whole, so it's going to let buyers chew off bits and pieces. Each buyer gets to renegotiate a labor contract. If Hostess is broken up, the workers would likely have less bargaining power, and the new owner might be less generous. Stacey Hickox is a labor professor at Michigan State University.
If they were purchased by another company that paid lower wages or had lower benefits for their employees, then the former Hostess employees would most likely be paid in line with those other employees.
Even if buyers do grab up some of its bakeries, Hostess expects many others won't get bidders. So no matter what, if there's a liquidation, the company says a lot of Hostess employees will be out of a job. Elsa Chang, NPR News.
Life of Pi and Cloud Atlas are two complicated, ambitious novels that have recently been adapted for the big screen. NPR's Elizabeth Blair explores what makes some singular narratives workable on film and what makes some fail.
Some books are challenging to film because they're challenging to read. Take James Joyce's Ulysses, a stream of consciousness masterpiece published in 1922.
And as for them saying that there's no God, well, I wouldn't give a snap of me two fingers for all their learning.
Ulysses was, for a very long time, considered unfilmable, both because of the complexity of the plot and the point of view of the characters.
Maria Konnikova is a freelance writer who recently explored unfilmable books for The Atlantic.
But it was done not once, but twice.
Other novels are considered unfilmable because they're too introspective and heady. Take Joseph Heller's dark World War II novel, Catch-22.
Both the paranoia and kind of the sense of helplessness in the plot makes it difficult to kind of get out of the head of the characters and translate that to the screen.
We gotta stop him.
But that didn't stop director Mike Nichols from trying.
They'll catch you. They'll bring you back.
I can do it.
This is insane.
I can do it.
Critics panned the movie Catch-22. Author Joseph Heller had mixed feelings about it, but he also said complex novels don't make good movies. And it's for that reason that another writer never thought one of his ambitious novels would ever make it to the screen.
Really, no. It's the truth.
David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas won a British Book Award and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize.
My only film-related thought when I was writing the book was, what a shame there's not a chance in hell that this book would ever be made into a film.
Cloud Atlas is all over the place, intentionally. It follows six completely different stories, from science fiction to crime thriller to romantic love story. It took three people to bring it to the screen, Andy and Lana Wachowski, who made the Matrix movies, and Tom Tickfer. Like the novel, there are six movies within the movie, set in the past.
The son he disinherited is none other than Robert Frobisher.
And the future. One of the many reasons David Mitchell thought his novel would never make it to the screen is the size of the cast it would take. It doesn't cost a writer a dime to add a character, but it can cost a filmmaker a lot to add an actor to a cast. The Wachowskis got around the problem by having actors play as many as 6 completely different roles. Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, and Hugh Grant, among others, are transformed to the point of being unrecognizable through the Hollywood magic of makeup and costumes. By doing it this way, David Mitchell believes the filmmakers also made it easier for viewers to understand his concept, one soul moving through many different worlds.
In a different body, in a different time, in a different age. So the directors have played to the advantages of film as a medium.
Played to the advantages of film as a medium. That was the only way director Ang Lee could adapt the novel Life of Pi.
My name is Pi Patel. I have been in a shipwreck. I am on a lifeboat alone with a tiger.
And in the movie, that tiger is stunningly real. Was the actor who plays Pi ever on the boat with a real tiger?
No.
So for director Ang Lee, the key to making the entire narrative believable was not an option.
I would like to, but we're not allowed to by 20th Century Fox.
So Ang Lee, who is known for taking risks, didn't do it. Instead, those scenes were shot separately with a combination of real tigers and computer-generated tigers. Technology has come so far that Ang Lee can put a boy and a tiger on a lifeboat together, and sometimes underwater. But technology alone isn't what will make Life of Pi as much of a success as the novel. Fortunately for 20th Century Fox, Ang Lee brings so many more talents to the table, not least of which is an extraordinary imagination. He was also given an enormous budget. But journalist Maria Konnikova believes there are filmmakers who overuse CGI at the expense of the story. Take the screen adaptations of Lord of the Rings. Even though they've been critically and commercially successful, Konnikova says they've lost the emotional depth of Tolkien's writings to what she calls special effects plot points.
You lose the kind of the dynamics, you lose the inner struggles that are happening within each character, which are so finely wrought on the page.
Konnikova thinks it's better to take the spirit of the novel and then work it into a new original movie.
The best adaptation of Jane Austen I've ever seen is Clueless, which was inspired by Emma.
Except that it takes place in a rich Beverly Hills high school in the 1990s.
Amy Heckerling showed an insight when she did that to make it so different that she completely, I think, captured the spirit of Jane Austen without really kind of dragging it down.
Oh, and this Josh and Ty thing was wigging me more than anything. I mean, what was my problem? Ty is my pal. I don't begrudge her a boyfriend. I wonder if they have that in my size.
Some movie versions fail because the filmmakers have tried to be too faithful to the original text, says Ang Lee.
There's a saying in the business, either you ruin a novel or make a great film, or you can be loyal to the book and make a bad movie.
Author David Mitchell says he's learned to be careful when filmmakers say they won't change a thing. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 20th of November, 2012. Microsoft Windows version 1 was released on this date, 1985. Bill Gates, Paul Allen had developed an operating system they called MS-DOS, which stood for Microsoft Disk Operating System. It shipped in IBM computers beginning in 1981, but it was not intuitive, and if you used it, you had to memorize a string of commands and get comfortable with the backslash key, something most people had never taken any notice of. So Microsoft designers began working on a more user-friendly operating system, and on this date in 1985, that Windows program was shipped. It's the birthday of the astronomer Edwin Powell Hubble, Marshfield, Missouri, 1889. He became a lawyer but gave up practicing law, decided to get a doctorate in astronomy instead, went to work at Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena, where he discovered there are other galaxies outside the Milky Way, and these distant galaxies are moving away from the Milky Way. In other words, the concept of the expanding universe, which has been called the most spectacular astronomical discovery of the 20th century. The Hubble telescope was named for him. And it's the birthday of the novelist Nadine Gordimer, born in Spring, South Africa, 1923. She grew up in a middle-class white community near a gold mine where all the black workers were forced to live in a windowless barracks guarded by police. Never thought about who those miners were or what their lives were like until she read a novel by Upton Sinclair, The Jungle. She moved into Johannesburg and started writing short stories, watched as many of her black friends were put under surveillance, arrested for treason. Nadine Gordimer, one of the few white novelists of her generation who did not go into exile, started to write about the South African political resistance in a series of novels, including The Late Bourgeois World, The Guest of Honor, The Conservationist. And for 60 years, she contributed short stories to The New Yorker magazine. In the short story, she said, "Contact is more like the flash of fireflies, in and out, now here, now there, in darkness. Short story writers see by the light of the flash." Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, entitled Shackleton's Decision. At a certain point, he decided they could not afford the dogs. It was someone's job to take them one by one behind a pile of ice and shoot them. I try to imagine the Arctic night which descended and would not lift, a darkness that clung to their clothes. Some men objected because the dogs were warmth and love, reminders of their previous life where they slept in soft beds, their bellies warm with supper. Dog tails were made of joy, their bodies were wrapped in a fur of hope. I had to put the book down when I read about the dogs walking willingly into death, following orders, one clutching an old toy between his teeth. They trusted the men who led them into this white danger, this barren cold. My God, they pulled the sleds full of provisions and barked away the sea leopards. Someone was told to kill the dogs because supplies were running low, and the dogs gathered around the fire, their tongues wet with kindness,